listeners of the Mad Scientist Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Cogswell, joined today by new friend of the show, Sally Best. Sally is the host of the Conspiracy Crushers Podcast. Sally, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's a bit cold over here in England, a bit of snow outside, but coping, you know?
Sure, yeah, yeah. It's, oh my goodness, so it's interesting. We just got like 6 inches of snow last night here in Boston, and it's just adding to the piles upon piles of snow. And in the place where I live now, we have kind of like a little outdoor garden area, and that garden area is becoming like a wall of snow that you just have to kind of walk through as it piles up on the sides of you, and we're just shoveling out a pathway. So it's pretty great. It's like, I don't know, it's kind of a cool, I don't know, a fantasy setting for getting out in the day. Sally, why don't you give our listeners a little bit of background on sort of your degree, your background in this field, and what made you want to get involved in the world of, you know, looking at conspiracy theories?
Okay, so I've got a biology background. I did a degree in environmental biology over here in England at the University of Nottingham. I spent my degree kind of doing a lot of environmental stuff. I did my human physiology and things. My thesis was based on working in Mexico and volunteering for a project called Operation Wallacea to try and work out remediation strategies to prevent declining populations of green turtles. And I worked with them for pretty much, I'm going to say 8 months on implementations and research. So I went over and I did the initial research and then came back and we collabed and things, and all the research goes to the Mexican government. And it basically informs policy and the way that they introduce things. So yeah, I had that kind of climate background as well as a general biology background. And I started, once I graduated in 2019, I started writing about climate issues, such as, you know, coral reef restoration. Very interested in ocean wildlife. And then I continued writing, and I started a journalism diploma last year. Now, when I started that, it was kind of the height of COVID. So everything was a bit crazy in the journalism scene. And I wanted to go in as a scientific journalist with a specialist, which is slightly niche, I'm going to say. I didn't really know any of the scientific journalists that were wanting to go into what I wanted to do and write about these things. Mm-hmm. And basically, when I started, I was seeing a lack of coherence between the media and scientists that were releasing, you know, peer-reviewed science publications on coronavirus and what they'd found. And there was a lot of lack of cohesion of politicians as well, quoting the science has changed when science doesn't change, as we know, evidence available changes. But yeah, I was just seeing this complete lack of cohesion, and it was really getting to me. And then also I was seeing the rise of conspiracy theories and fake news just grow in ridiculous quantities on Facebook, social media, Twitter. And it was really getting to me. And I would read through the comments and just become slightly enraged at some of the things that were, one, being reported on, two, that people were taking on board and commenting on, and three, that places like Facebook and Twitter were letting exist and actually being a conduit for propagation. Mm-hmm. And it was really getting to me. So I basically, my dad's also a scientist. He was a physiologist, sorry, in biochemistry and diabetes research. And I basically would kind of have conversations with him about it. and came up with the idea of creating a podcast that went back to the root of conspiracy and, say, confirmation bias, the social echo chamber effect, and identified and pinpointed why conspiracy exists, how it's propagated, and how to debunk some of these theories with hardcore scientific fact, if that makes sense.
Oh, it absolutely makes sense. It's funny. I am always so excited when another show comes out and just another person comes out and says, hey, you know, I'm really interested in these subjects. I'm interested in these in a serious way, you know, because that's really the same things that you're talking about, that same distinction, or I guess the disparity between what a scientific article says or what a scientist reports on, and then what actually makes its way out there to the world through science journalism or through not even science journalism, but just regular journalism, was such a huge concern for me when I was in grad school and when I was in undergrad even, and thinking about these problems. And then it just gets, like you said, it just gets exacerbated. It just gets worse when people are kind of siloed into these echo chambers of social media where, again, you know, it's no one is giving any sort of fact checking. No one is even attempting to think critically about these things. You just share over and over again what you think that makes sense to you or what you think makes sense to those around you. And it just ends up where, you know, suddenly you're talking about how, you know, this new the new COVID vaccine is Bill Gates putting a tracking chip inside of you. It's a really easy slope for people to fall down into, and it's one that I don't think that we've ever as societies really given enough credence to how problematic and how dangerous that process can be.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's also kind of not criticizing, criticizing, you know, people that are writing about things that are unqualified. And I'm not trying to come from a high horse position, but to know how to write about these things, you have to have had experience of reading scientific papers, because number one, they are lengthy. And you've got to know where to start. You've got to know what the statistical analysis means. You've got to know what the output is. And as a whole, being able to read that, digest it, and then reproduce it, it's a really difficult occupation that you've got to tackle. And unless you've had experience in that field, I don't necessarily think there's the positivity in writing about it and putting articles out there. Like for me, I know a bit about, say, British politics. I know a bit about American politics. Would I ever write about them? Absolutely not, because I don't feel like I have the basis on which to write about them. And it's the danger in journalism that this not new field is emerging, but this field of scientific journalism is emerging. But it's an uncharted territory whereby people aren't necessarily qualified that are writing about it, and they don't have that, you know, precedent and experience to do so in a way that they would in politics or foreign affairs, you know?
Well, I think part of the issue, and it's interesting because I think from, you know, our shows cover pretty similar, I think kind of, we have similar goals with our shows, and we have similar kind of background theories as to what what we want to get out of these shows, or what we want to get out of our own communication in these ways, is both pick apart and find how those conspiracy theories spread, but also think of ways that we can really successfully, not even necessarily successfully, because I don't know if convincing people is even possible in some cases, but at least meaningfully engaging with people. You know, that I think that is really the challenge that science has had, especially, and it's sort of a self-inflicted wound in some ways. But I guess one thing that I think will be really fascinating And I really push listeners of this show to go and listen to the Conspiracy Crushers show, is your perspective on it coming from the UK versus, say, here in America. You know, it's interesting. So recently, actually, there was a podcast that came out that looked at a topic that actually was my first foray into this topic of conspiracy theory and science interacting really, really interestingly, which was the switch over from wood burning stoves to coal burning stoves in the United Kingdom versus in America. Have you ever looked at any of that?
No, I haven't. I read an article really recently, actually, that was about wood burners emitting toxic fumes, but I haven't looked into the actual topic.
So I want to say it was, oh my goodness, I have to find it now. It was a really interesting, it's a really interesting problem. It's a really interesting question. And so when I find it, listeners, I will put it in the show notes here. But anyways, and I want to say it was a big podcast, a big science podcast that put it out there too. So I'm kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm blanking on this name right now. But anyways, what's interesting is, so in the United States, coal for a long time was viewed really, really negatively. And obviously that's not the case anymore. We kind of switched over to like loving coal, but even in the United States today, still a non-insignificant portion of heating comes from burning of wood. It's not actually coal burning anymore. It's wood burning, or not, you know, petrochem or whatever. But Europe, and specifically the United Kingdom, where this conversation is really usually based, because the UK and America are so common or so commonly viewed as being kind of, you know, sister countries, that in the UK, they shifted to coal much more readily than they did in the United States. I don't even think it was the whole UK either. I'm trying to think. This might have just focused on like Britain. But anyways, the reason that they shifted over to coal more readily than the United States did was because we just had more trees. You know, in the 1800s, at the turn of like the Industrial Revolution, we had still huge swaths of trees that were not cut down yet, but Europe and, you know, the UK didn't anymore. And so the shift to coal was eased in that region. But in the United States, it lagged behind something like 100 years that we really switched over to burning coal as the major source of fuel. And in the United States versus, say, the UK, we still see things like that happen where obviously we speak the same language, but our cultures are very, in many ways, similar, that they kind of come from the same initial starting point, right? Where the founders of this country were mostly immigrants from the UK. And even I think Australia, to some extent, I'd be interested to see that comparison too. But the way that technology is accepted in these regions is really fascinating and how different it can be. But I'd also argue, and I'd also be really interested in seeing how conspiracy theories are accepted or propagated in these areas compared to each other. Because I would wager or expect that a lot of the technological, a lot of the economic, social, political reasons that technologies either are accepted more readily or are not accepted more readily also will play a role in conspiracy theories, although maybe in ways we don't expect, since conspiracy theories are so often not based on any kind of truth.
Yeah.
Anyways, that was like a super long tangent. One question I have that I think is a really interesting case of this is, so in the United States, we've always had a culture where basically everyone's opinion on everything is viewed as equally valid, much to our own detriment, I would argue, in some cases. So like the United States, a good example of this is religion. In the United States, our founding mythology is that people came over here because they wanted to practice religion away from the control of the Pope or the state or whatever, you know. And of course, people came over here, the pilgrims, or, you know, the Plymouth colonists came over specifically to practice a stultifying, super, super strict form of Christianity. But the argument or the idea, I think, has always been that people can come here and believe what they want. Do you feel like that same kind of viewpoint exists even in the UK?
So I think in terms of religion, it's a very different kettle of fish here in some ways. In terms of believing, you know, believing what you want, and everybody having this this kind of same value of opinion, I think, you know, people are allowed to have the same level of opinion and given the same credit irrespective of their qualifications. So we talked about this in my first episode, actually, and this kind of idea that, you know, everyone's opinion is valid. Mm-hmm. And I think, so my first guest used this really, really great example that was, you know, if you're not going to trust people, so if you wouldn't trust anybody other than a doctor with medical health, if you wouldn't trust anybody other than a dentist with dental health, if you wouldn't trust anybody other than an environmentalist with environmental health, why on earth would you trust people other than science journalists with science journalism, if that makes sense? And you get this propagation and people commenting on things that they, you know, they've read things, they feel entitled and informed and like they've got a grasp of what they know is going on. And I think the main thing is there's platforms for these people to exist, which is why they exist, which is, you know, Facebook, social media. You've got comment sections. Everyone has their comments open. There's always this propensity and this, you know, people can exist in this way. In terms of religion, I think it is very different over here. I think it's very divided in the way that religions are, and although we're mainly a Church of England country, you know, we've got immigrants from all over the world, which I think is lovely, but as you know, there's always clashes and things. I think in response to that, I don't know if it's necessarily the same entitled everybody has. I don't really know what I'm trying to say here.
Well, yeah. So I guess like I was actually before this scouring my brain. In my mind, the perfect example of this kind of ideal going off the rails in the United States, at least, is our culture of cults. Like, we have a tremendous number of cult belief systems in the United States, you know, from like Scientology to, you know, pastors in like Louisiana holding church services, holding rattlesnakes or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, we have a really strong history of kind of religious con men creating communes around themselves, and people just sort of being like, well, those are the wacky people down the hill who believe that, you know, John is an alien overlord. But I don't think that really exists, and maybe I'm just not well versed in it, but I don't really think that exists in, say, it doesn't exist in the same way in other countries. You know, you have cults in, like, say, Japan, but they all have their own kind of brand, right? Like, Japanese cults tend to be very, like, you know, I don't know. It's like you can tell on paper, like, this is probably a cult that's from Japan because the social structures within the cult are a certain way. Whereas in the U.S., it's always like some, you know, they're just random. They're all over the place. They can be anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think personally, I'd always credit that to the size of America. And the states and the division. And, you know, it's such a large area. And I always find it weird with, you know, politics and things that you have one president
Oh, it's wacky.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you've got so many states, massive populations, and to be able to have cohesion between even, you know, one state, let alone 50 of them, it's crazy. I just, that would be where I'd think the divides would come in, that you know, there isn't this kind of unity, as it were, because there are so many different areas and so many different cultures that are amalgamating in really weird ways. I'd say in England and Great Britain, United Kingdom, our population is a lot smaller.
Mm.
The area that we're over is a lot smaller. Our cultures kind of, it doesn't vary from one end to the other. Whereas in America, you know, the culture's just divided across so many different states.
You know, it's interesting, actually. I think you're really onto something with that. The more I sort of ponder it in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, really the most successful cults, and in some ways the most successful conspiracy theories in the United States, exist because they are, first off, they're not really headquartered anywhere. Or if they are, they kind of move between states. So there's not, you know, it is bringing an amalgamation of people together. I guess maybe the better example, or maybe the better comparison that isn't really comparing our problems with conspiracy theory to, you know, the UK, let's say, but maybe more to just Europe, right? Or, you know, but that's, again, it's kind of, we're a weird case because we all speak the same language basically, except for, like, you know, downtown Boston and like Louisiana. it's an interesting thing. All right. Well, with that, we're going to go into our first break. So Sally, I want to get into some fun stuff here. And I mean, of course, you know, conspiracy theories are, it's interesting. We hear a lot from people online. Oh, you know, you take this too seriously. Conspiracy theories should be fun and everything else. And it's like, yeah, they're fun until, you know, your country is almost taken over by a nutcase. So, you know, it is a little fun until there's a coup attempt. But what is the craziest conspiracy theory that you would say has a sizable portion of belief in the UK?
Sizable proportion of belief.
Or just like what's a popular, I guess, because I'm thinking, again, our craziest conspiracy theory is like that Hillary Clinton drinks baby blood right now. You know what I mean? Like and so maybe it is just the US takes everything up to 11. So our crazy conspiracy theory is the craziest. But I'm wondering, what is the craziest conspiracy theory you've heard of existing in your region?
I think we get a lot of like crop circle things that I've kind of experienced, which I don't know how to engage. The weirdest ones are, so it was really, it's kind of fair enough. There was this conspiracy theory that our government was made up of lizards and they're not actually humans.
Oh yeah, David Icke. Yeah, you guys have David Icke. Yep.
Which is just absolutely absurd. Obviously the moon landings and things like being fake. I'm trying to think of some more interesting ones that aren't massively detrimental.
It's so hard. Like I think like a couple of years ago, if you had asked me, what's a conspiracy theory you think is fun that isn't really detrimental to things, I'd have like a list of a couple of them. But in the modern world where you're thinking, again, just how easy it is to go from, like you said, the moon landing is fake to, you know, Tony Blair was actually a lizard person. That change is not as far a leap as I think we once thought it was. And so they all look dangerous. None of them appear benign anymore.
Yeah, no, it just does really kind of venture into really scary territory. Mm-hmm. I'm really trying to rack my brain for other ones that I found amusing. I think most of the time I'm absolutely petrified by them in all seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
Other than the lizard one, I feel fair enough, you know. I could even get on board with that. Just because of the behaviour of some of our government. Obviously not, just a disclaimer. Don't quote me on that. But yeah, there's some, like in our first episode as well, we kind of broke down into, you know, benign conspiracy and really dangerous conspiracy. And yeah, our benign were, you know, the lizards and the moon landing. I'm really trying to think of other ones. I think even this weird 4G mast thing. It's hysterical. It's not benign, but it's hysterical. Because I don't understand what people thought came before that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Right. Well, so that is... Yeah, I don't know. The mask, the conspiracies that we're seeing with masks, you know, in the U.S., our flavor of those conspiracies are always the government is trying to... In the U.S., we have a real, like, fetish for the idea that the government is coming to, like, control us all. There's some portion of the American populace that would, I think, love to be right about living in 1984. You know, they're waiting for the day that the government's like, you know, you can't, they're just waiting. They're waiting for the day to be like, I told you we were going to all go to the re-education centers. But yeah, the mask thing has that's really what it's become here is the government is trying to control you. They're using the vaccine to distribute a microchip that'll allow the government to control you. Like, it's always that same central belief, right? The government wants to control you. And it's like, I mean, kind of, that's like what governments are made to do is to control the populace and protect you from the whims of other people. But, you know, that's kind of a benefit of government in some cases. It's not always super evil. You know, it's not always the worst thing ever.
Yeah, I think especially like with us and, you know, our government has a political mandate and for our population to be given the vote on Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
Was an absolute catastrophe. I mean, irrespective of the way that it went or not, I know which way I'm inclined, but these people aren't informed to make decisions about, you know, political repercussions and I don't know, populations need this kind of higher power to make informed decisions that they don't know about. And mm-hmm. I think the distance between people and the government is sometimes used as this this weird territory in which they think there are things going on that they don't know about. But I think giving people control on the other end of the scale can also lead to destruction as well. You know, we live in a democracy, but democracy to an extent that we trust our leaders in making decisions for us. That's what we vote them in for, to make decisions. We don't vote them in so they give us decisions, if that makes sense. I just, it's a really weird one.
It's an interesting, I think it is really an interesting, I do think it's a really interesting, again, an interesting difference in culture, because although I think that is logically what most Americans should see their politicians doing, I don't think that's what we think of politicians as doing. I don't think most Americans trust their politicians to make good decisions for them. I think a good portion of Americans would think that they themselves could do better than the politicians. We have an entire, I mean, I know like you guys have you have the liberals and conservatives as well, but our conservatives, and not even all just conservatives, but there's a large portion of the population that I think believes, or I know believes, not that I think, I know believes based on statistics and surveying, that there frankly shouldn't be a government, that they don't need government. They don't need somebody making these decisions for them. And it is part of, I think, the larger, again, history of America, that we've always felt that way, that, you know, we don't need someone from someplace else or someone from a different background deciding for me what's best for me and my family. I can do that myself. But in the modern day, it's become magnified where, again, kind of political parties are utilizing, you know, grievance and racial disparities and fear about change and everything else to, again, make – they're using that as a weapon here where they're saying these people who look differently than you, that act differently than you, that have different backgrounds than you, they want to decide for you, and you can't trust them. And that has been a wildly successful – and I think it's similar, again, to what was part of the Brexit campaign, right, was that same argument. You know, we're going to let Europeans decide for us. That's been a really effective message here in America, and it's – I don't think it's really any surprise that the same forces in America that were pushing that narrative and have been so successfully started working with the forces in the UK that decided to start pushing the Brexit storyline. So, yeah, it's really interesting, though, the way that it plays differently, I think, or how to change that message around. But again, as with all conspiracy theories, it's ultimately the same story. You're just changing the window dressing in some way.
Yeah, definitely.
So what, I guess, one thing that we've heard in the, one thing that I think is taken for granted as being true here is that in the United States, the assassination of JFK, which that happened in like the 1960s, towards the end of the 60s to the 70s, that the assassination of JFK and the related kind of political turmoil created the modern day conspiracy theory culture that we have in the United States, right? And excuse me, it happened in 63 in Texas, Dallas, Texas, of course. And then the fallout from that kind of occurred up until, say, the 70s. But we're still feeling it today in some ways. But like you said, there are conspiracy theories that are growing and thriving in the UK and in other countries too. Is there a central moment, or is there, I guess, sort of a period of time that you think conspiracy theories were really successful in growing in the UK?
So we've kind of talked about this on our episode as well, and Origin. It's really hard to document. I think in terms of vaccine conspiracy, there was definitely the event in the 90s, which was Andrew Wakefield's research on the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella. And he basically said that it caused autism in recipients. And as I've said, he's been completely thrown out. His research has been completely thrown out and deemed null and void. But I think even, so what am I? I'm nearly 23 now. And even when I was receiving my measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, there was this air of caution. A lot of people weren't vaccinating their children. I personally received three separate doses, which was advised by a doctor at the hospital that I was vaccinated at, because receiving the full dose didn't seem kind of entirely safe, which it completely is, but it didn't seem safe at that time. Now, I know parents of friends who still believe that research was valid and that it could cause autism in recipients. I know people that haven't had that vaccine. And I know people that are now have latched onto that scare and apply it to other vaccines. and refused to get vaccinated in a lot of ways. So I think that was a really, really key conspiracy in terms of the scientific community that enabled this propagation of future doubt. And the thing is with doubt, once it's there, it never, ever goes, because it's always this kind of tinkering, lingering feeling. And it's really, really difficult to actually discredit a scientist with evidence. It's really difficult. So yeah, to answer, I think that would be, you know, the major point for immunology conspiracy theories. I can't speak on behalf of you know, more other conspiracy theories that
sure
aren't so scientific. But I'd also argue as well that when did Facebook come in? 2003, was it?
Something like that, yeah.
I'd say that had a massive, massive effect on the way that you know, things are publicized, really.
Hmm. So one thing that's really interesting, so in the U.S. there are, so the U.S. we've had, I guess, a lot of medical scandals that have also led to people in specific communities being really careful, and I think I've heard people call it resistance to vaccination, but I think that's probably incorrect, because resistance sort of suggests that there's not a good reason. I think cautious is probably maybe a better word for it. But so, for example, in the United States, what's called the Tuskegee syphilis study, where from the 30s until like really a super long time, from like the 30s to the 70s, the government of the United States basically studied how syphilis affected people and didn't affect people. And so they basically just did all this, they pretended to be treating people for syphilis, but were in fact trying to observe the effects of untreated syphilis. And this happened on black males, specifically in the United States. And so that sort of history has led people to really be much more cautious in those communities to do anything the government tells them to do with regards to health. And some public health methods have been developed to really help fix that. But I guess I wonder, like, I'm thinking in the UK, I know you had, like, say, like thalidomide, right? That was a huge scandal. I don't think it ended up actually affecting that many people. It was like in the thousands, I want to say. But I know that there are still people today surviving with the birth defects caused by thalidomide. Has that ever really been explored, I guess? Or do you think that has any place to play here? Or was it, like, I guess I'm wondering, could scandals like, say, the thalidomide scandal cause people to be more, again, cautious against that? Or have you never really even heard that as an argument? It's more the kind of conspiracy theory stuff we hear of normally, say, like here, you know, just everywhere.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point with thalidomide. And the thing about that is, obviously, it took 9 months for any signs to show up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, mothers were given it for morning sickness, and then mm-hmm. they had their gestational period and then gave birth. And it was only then that ramifications were truly understood. Whereas in other trials of other natures, there isn't the same kind of longevity, and it wouldn't necessarily be trialed on women with child. So I do think it's a really good point. And even so far as to say, I think they've tried to rebrand thalidomide in other ways of, I think that was like cancer treatment.
Yeah, it is still used for some things, but it's like, you know, it's a pretty big that's a pretty big PR night. I mean, like, I can't believe they tried to rebrand it at all, or that it's been successful. But anyways, continue. Sorry.
Yeah. No. It's tricky. But I think once people have these, you know, doubts, and it was a mistake, and I I'd hope that the way that they trial drugs in that way has changed. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, even with this vaccine, that scares a lot of people is the fact that it's come about so quickly. I think the main thing to emphasize is that this vaccine has gone through all of the required trials, clinical trials that it should do. And one of the reasons that it's come about so quickly is because of a lot of knowledge on coronaviruses as a group, as right. opposed to, you know, it's a novel coronavirus, but coronavirus isn't novel to scientists. You know, there's a lot of documentation on it, a lot of genetic sequencing that had already been done. But yeah, I think that there is this fear of things that haven't been trialed before, things that are novel. And I think a lot of people would want to wait a certain period before they knew effects and things. And just this lack of trust. And I think instances such as the thalidomide instance will plant a seed of doubt in people's minds. But I think comparably, you know, with this virus, vaccine, sorry, we put a hell of a lot of crap into our bodies every day that we wouldn't think twice about. You know, I think in England, there's especially this, we're quite kind of not dependent on alcohol, but it's very much a social, it's there for kind of social events, and our culture is very much founded on, you know, going to the pub, watching the football, sure. while at the pub, drinking, going to nightclubs and things. And the, you know, there's clear evidence that alcohol is really, really blooming damaging for loads of internal organs in your body and can cause various cancers and things. But people drinking alcohol, you wouldn't think twice about those ramifications, even though there's, you know, tons of evidence on it. But when it comes to a vaccine, there's this hesitation, and it's that sort of thing that really worries me, but also confuses me, because, you know, there's things that you just wouldn't consider about causing harm that you know cause harm. But as soon as there's something that's been peer-reviewed, has gone through a series of clinical trials, people are hesitant. And yeah, I guess it's just one of those things. You've got to increase the connectivity of scientists and the media and communicate the safety and efficacy of these things, really.
Yeah, it is a funny, it's become one of my favorite, I guess, sort of jokes or memes that's come out from this period, is people saying, you know, if you smoke a 12-pack a day of cigarettes, I don't want to hear you say that you're worried about what the vaccine will do to you.
Yeah.
You know, like you do not care about what you put in your body. It's, you know, but it's an interesting, it's part of me wonders if it is not just how relatively rare people who know about the sciences, who know about things like, say, peer review, or even, you know, even in this case, say, like, if we just think generally, you know, how many, like, I've gone to, you know, we've gone to conferences to talk about our show and talk about conspiracy theories, and even gone to conferences specifically, you know, promoting, you're not really promoting, but, you know, full of people who believe conspiracy theories, and talking to them and having them say, you know, you're the first scientist I've ever met in my entire life. That's a problem. You know, we're like people who have higher degrees or who even just study the sciences in school, they're relatively rare. They tend to cluster in certain parts of the country. Like, I know in the United States, at least, it's basically, you know, your chances of meeting someone with a higher level degree, you know, obviously it increases drastically the closer you get to a university, but most people don't live near universities. You know, so it is, I think, part of the problem is there's not enough communication. There's just not enough kind of interesting media that people can consume. And it's frankly why I'm so excited you're doing your show. I'm really happy to have another. I'm so happy always to see shows come out that I think are having this kind of mindset, talking about this stuff seriously and really trying to get to the bottom of it. So I'm just so excited. And I'm so thankful you decided to come on the show here today with us. Anything you want listeners to know, where can they find you?
So we're on Podbeans at the minute, hoping to get a few more episodes out and get onto Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So we're the Conspiracy Crushers. And I think with science conspiracies, debunking, and hoping to just kind of go through a journey, a logical journey of, you know, moving through. So we're starting our next one on vaccine conspiracy, and then hoping to go more into coronavirus vaccine conspiracy, and then onto coronavirus conspiracies. So, you know, bit of natural progression, but if people want, have, you know, theories that they'd kind of like us to discuss and attempt to debunk, look into a bit of research, you know, that's what we're hoping to do. Just a lot of research on these things. It's, I think the one of the common misconceptions as well is that this is all, you know, off the top of the head and things. And planning for podcast episodes, it takes a while in terms of searching up these things and coming up with clear, coherent arguments and evidence.
Oh my God. It's people who come over to our apartment, not that that's happened since like COVID has gone on, but you know what I mean? Like, people that come over for the first time and see our bookshelves, like, we have normal books, and then we have things like, you know, Hitler's on the moon still, right? Like, it's like, oh my God. No, I'm researching. I swear I'm just researching. I don't believe that crazy thing. Oh, yeah. You know, it takes a long time, and it really is. Oh God, it just is a labor of love until it happens.
Yeah, and you get down a rabbit hole as well. You really stumble down rabbit holes. And I think especially in loads and loads of different places, there's different conspiracy theories. Like I'd know a slight bit about theories in England. But then as you move to kind of Europe, even America, African countries, there's just, you know, so many different rabbit holes that you delve down that you didn't know existed, and you get a bit lost.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's easy to come out of that. Easy to come out of the internet hole. Like, what is happening? Yeah. Well, Sally Best, thank you so much for coming on, folks. The show is called The Conspiracy Crushers. It is a new podcast. Check it out, please. It's available on Podbean. Once it's available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, we will promote the heck out of it on Twitter for you all and on Facebook and things. And please check the show notes too. We'll have links there. Sally, thanks again so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at MadScientistPod or at Team Giant Squid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
We love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard.
Woohoo!
And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.